everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling with you, and with me, as always, is Brandon Odo.
You.
We thought we'd talk a little bit about APRV today. And that's a mode of ventilation that not all of us are super duper familiar with. And those who have used it maybe aren't super duper comfortable with. So we thought we'd talk about it a little bit. Nuts and bolts, nitty gritty of how to use it, when to use it, etc. And we thought we'd get some help. So we have Rory Spiegel with us. Rory is an emergency medicine physician and intensivist at the Washington Hospital Center in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. and an expert in all things APRV. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
All right, Rory, I'm going to tell you about a patient who comes to your ICU, and I want your expert advice on how to handle this person, because I think the majority of us in critical care have at least heard of APRV by one name or another, but the number who use it at all or at all routinely is a much smaller number, and the subset of those who really are an expert is all the smaller. So I want your, like, on the ground, practical perspective on handling this.
Sure.
You are on service and you hear about a 60-year-old male. Comes to your ICU, he's got some hypertension and diabetes. He is obese with a BMI of 40. He has some CKD. He comes to the hospital with a fever. He's hypoxic. They think he perhaps has a community-acquired pneumonia. Maybe some element of CHF, and probably some obesity hypoventilation. They place him on BiPAP, send him to the step-down unit, and then he has a rapid response called for worsening dyspnea. His ABG shows both hypercarbia and hypoxia, and he has a great deal of work of breathing. So he ends up intubated and brought to the ICU. You come on the next morning, and you find him there, as he has been overnight, on a volume control, assist control mode, with a tidal volume of 450. He has a rate of 20. He's on 100% FiO2 with a PEEP of 12. And he ended up on that much oxygen and PEEP because he was persistently hypoxic. His last ABG on these settings has a pH of 7.30, a PCO2 of 50, a PO2 of 62, and he's satting 90%. He is sedated on propofol at 50 mics per kilo per minute. He's on fentanyl at 200 mics per hour. And this was all because he was a little bit desynchronous on the vent overnight and they wanted him to cool down. He is not paralyzed or anything. He has peak pressures of about 40 right now and plateaus of 37. He has some secretions and his chest x-ray just shows diffuse patchy airspace disease. So first of all, a patient like this, would you say, just on first glance, is a good candidate for APRV?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think when you think about APRV, what you're really thinking about is essentially CPAP with release, with the goal of the mode to start getting someone back to their functional residual capacity, or the FRC, and then allowing them to breathe on their own. So when you think of it from that standpoint, it's anyone where you think their lung volumes are significantly below what they should be, and your goal is trying to bring them back to that. Yeah, so this guy, you know, just even in the sense, even without his pneumonia or CHF or whatever we think he has, his obesity and his sedation on the vent, he's going to start losing lung volumes fairly quickly. So yeah, APRV would work nicely on him.
Now, a more conventionally minded person would say, all that's true, but the way that I'm going to open that lung is through PEEP. So what is the benefit or the increased benefit of going to APRV versus just using a, quote, conventional mode and putting them on a lot of PEEP?
So, I mean, the simplest question, the simplest answer to that is most people just don't use enough PEEP. That the PEEPs, even on a high PEEP table, are still fairly low. And then the other issue is you're still doing standard modes of ventilation over the top of that, which are fairly uncomfortable and require a significant amount of sedation. And so you end up creating all this iatrogenesis from your sedation, from your fluids, from so on and so forth. And then the final thing that I think is somewhat lost in people that don't do APRV is, what is the right PEEP? right? Like that's always our epic goal, is to find the right PEEP for any patient. And we have PEEP titration. We try to find individual PEEPs on patients looking at their static compliance. You can put an esophageal probe in to find out. And none of these work that well. The nice thing about APRV is you don't really have to know prospectively what the ideal PEEP is. You're going to put them on APRV, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a little bit. And eventually you're going to end up at some PEEP level that's optimal for the patient. But you don't have to know it prospectively. You kind of naturally get there over the course of the patient's treatment.
So when you say not enough PEEP, like the high PEEP on the table is still low PEEP, what numbers are we talking about?
Even high PEEP tables, you know, your PEEP is 24, right? Is usually your max PEEP on your high PEEP table, I think. I haven't used a PEEP table in a while, but I think it's somewhere around 24, which on this guy may not be enough, right? I mean, he's got a fairly high BMI. He's already got lung injury, and that might not even be enough to start opening up alveoli.
And it sounds like you're saying that even if you could convince people to use a great deal more PEEP on a regular mode, then delivering breaths on top of that has a good chance of being lung injurious. And I'm sure we're going to hear about how that may not be the case in APRV because we're not stacking breaths on top of that per se.
Sure. Yeah. There's that part. And there's just the comfort level on a standard mode of ventilation and how you ventilate people, which again, I think we'll talk about in a little bit, makes it much harder. You have to sedate people at a much higher level. And it just slows your progression down.
Okay. So we'll dig into some of this, but let's just get started with some practicalities. Perhaps you come on service, you say, you know what this guy needs? APRV. What sort of initial settings are you placing somebody on? You know, a patient like this, we all kind of have a practical approach to setting tidal volumes and rates and things on something like assist control. How do you handle it in APRV?
Yeah, so I mean, most of the time when you're setting APRV, you're doing it off another mode of ventilation. So you could be, you know, you directly place someone on APRV right after you intubate them. And that's not that hard to do once you're comfortable with APRV, but most of the time, the simple way to teach just to start off is to switch someone to APRV from a standard mode of ventilation like volume AC. And so you can use your volume AC settings to get an idea of where you might end up on APRV. With the caveat is you're going to do a lot of tinkering right after you put them on it and maybe change some of those. But if you take someone on volume AC, the things you're looking at are essentially trying to figure out what your P high is. Your P low is easy. It's always zero. And then what your T high and T low are. And your P high, which is essentially your pressure high or the time you're going to be spending on your high pressure throughout your respiratory cycle, is almost always around your plateau pressure. So plateau plus or minus two is usually where you can put your P high. I usually do two less than your plateau to start and then kind of look at it and figure it out afterwards.
Now, tell me why that makes sense. Because, I mean, that's what I've heard as well. But obviously, the plateau on their other mode could be whatever you want it to be based on what sort of tidal volume or pressure you were giving them. So why is that the right way to start?
Well, so you're right. It's not perfect, right? If the volume control mode settings are completely out of whack, this is going to leave you with completely incorrect settings. But it is essentially just an easy place to start, which will hopefully get you to the kind of higher part of your inflection curve on your pressure volume curve. And again, once you set them there, it might be completely incorrect. But we'll talk about as we go forward, and as your understanding of APRV goes up, you can kind of look at APRV settings and see what needs to be changed based on what release volumes you're getting, how long the release volume is, so on and so forth. But it's probably the easiest way. I mean, your only other way of doing it is essentially just kind of estimating by looking at the patient and how sick they are, right?
So I guess the way this would scale is that the worse their compliance, the more pressure they'll need to recruit. So the higher their plateau pressure, assuming they weren't on a totally bonkers tidal volume, that implies they do have a worse compliance. So like this guy's plateau is 37, and while maybe one of our goals would be to have him on less than that, it does imply that he's going to need a lot of pressure to recruit. So we're going to start with a high P high.
Yeah, exactly. And then what you're going to do is once you flip them to APRV, you're going to see what your release volumes look like. And you're going to decide if you think this plateau is the appropriate level for this patient. Now, you inherently do this with your normal modes of ventilation too, right? You intubate someone and the respiratory therapist asks you what your settings are and you kind of make something up based on your clinical experience and what you know about the mode, right? APRV, it seems a little weird and different because it, for most people, it's somewhat alien, but you could conceptually do the same thing where you look at someone and say, yeah, they'll probably need a P high of 37. You know, given how sick their lungs are, their T low should probably be 0.4. Again, the P low is always zero. And I want to ventilate them quite frequently to start because their minute ventilation is fairly high. So I'm going to put them on a T high of 2. Right? Like I could do that right off intubation. But most of the time you can use your previous settings to guide you.
So walking through these, we're going to set our P high more or less where your plateau pressure was. And then your T high is going to be...
Yeah. So your T high essentially amounts to what your respiratory rate is, how often you're going to drop out, right? Your respiratory cycle is your T high plus your T low. But since your T low is going to be a fixed number, which we'll talk about in a little bit, changing your respiratory rate or changing, I like to talk about it more in the form of minute ventilation, changing your minute ventilation is going to be done almost entirely by changing your T high. The lower your T high is, the more often you drop out, right? So the more times you release per minute. Ideally, you'd like the patient to be up at the high pressure as long as possible so you get more recruitment. Right. But you're at this constant conflict of wanting to stay at P high and recruit them, but also having to ventilate them over time. Right. As you recruit someone, so the longer you stay at P high, the closer you get them to FRC, the better you improve their minute ventilation needs, and the easier it is to ventilate them going forward. Right. So you're always battling this long-term goal of recruitment and improving ventilation over time versus I need to recruit them right now and dropping out as much as I need. What I've found clinically is you can actually exist at fairly low T highs and still recruit quite effectively. So I really try to match the patient's minute ventilation requirements as close as I can early on. Meaning if someone's on a standard mode of ventilation and has a minute ventilation of 12 or so, I'm going to get as close as I can get to that with my APRV settings, with an understanding that almost always you lose a little bit of minute ventilation when you flip someone from a standard mode to APRV. And that comes because your release volumes are almost always smaller than the tidal volumes you set them on. That's just a simple math of how you're setting your vent if you're using their previous vent settings to kind of set your APRV settings. And then because your T high, you know, is at lowest like 1.5, but most of the time you're setting it around 2 to start, you're just not going to be ventilating them quite as frequently, right? But you want to get as close as you can because again, like if I go from a minute ventilation of 12 to 10, I'm losing minute ventilation and I'm hoping to gain that with recruitment and improving their VQ mismatch, right? And I don't know how long that's gonna take. Everyone's lung kind of reacts differently to APRV. Some people open up really quickly, others take days. So I try to match that minute ventilation early on until I have an understanding of how their lung's gonna act.
So what are kind of the practical minimum maximum T high that you will use?
So a maximum is infinite, right? Like a maximum is essentially once you're on CPAP, right? But when you're putting someone on APRV, they're usually too sick to have them on fairly high T highs at the start of their ventilatory journey. That's why you're putting them on APRV. And so standard, I usually start somewhere around 2. If they're super, super sick, I would say the lowest you can go is about 1.5. When you start going lower than that, it's pretty hard to get any significant recruitment with it. That being said, you know, there's not many patients I've had that I've had to go lower than 1.5. I mean, there's not many patients that have to go lower than 2. I mean, back in the early COVID days when we had super, super sick, very small lungs, there were some. But for the most part, you can get away with a T high of 2.
Okay. And it would be uncommon to go much longer than that to start out. That would be more during weaning, which, I mean, as you said, even that is already probably a much higher mean airway pressure than they had on any regular mode.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that's probably one of the most common mistakes that people make when putting them onto APRV is they just set a T high of like 4, something that's just way too high, right? And you have a patient with a minute ventilation of 12 and you're dropping them to a minute ventilation of 6, right? Without any meaningful recruitment. And a lot of people fail APRV just because that setting is completely wrong. And not surprisingly, their CO2 shoots up incredibly high. Everyone gets worried and flip them off it.
Okay. So that's T high, T low. I'm gonna give you a statement and you tell me if it's correct. The T low should be set at whatever time cuts off the release at 75% of the peak expiratory flow.
Yeah, I mean, I technically that's correct, right? Like, so you're going to set it off. So if your peak expiratory flow is 100, you're going to cut it off at 75. That's like an easy way to think about it. Now, the caveat here is this is based off, you know, pig and sheep studies where you look at their alveolar recruitment under a microscope. And what you're going for is the most amount of bulk ventilation. So the most amount of air movement to breathe off CO2 was very little change in alveolar size. And what they found was as you started to drop below that 75%, you actually started to see your alveoli collapse, right? And so the magic of APRV is this T low, is this ability to get bulk ventilation with get very little loss of alveolar size. And so you're able to continue your recruitment even though you're dropping your pressure out. One of the important things to understand about APRV is you're not using your P low to control recruitment, de-recruitment. You're using your P low to get high flows and hopefully get high air bulk or high bulk air movement and high and effective ventilation. You're using your T low to control de-recruitment, right? And the idea is I'm starting at a P high pressure, I'm dropping out to zero, but I'm reinflating the lung way before the lung actually gets to that pressure. Right. And so you're using the speed at which you reinflate the lung to control that recruitment. That's your T low. It's the most important setting, I think, in APRV. If you set this wrong, you're not doing APRV.
And depending on the ventilator, you might have to set that by squinting at your waveform and estimating it, or some of them will let you set a kind of how much flow decay to cycle at, right?
Yeah, so most ventilators, it will tell you your peak and end expiratory flows. Sometimes it's like three screens back, but most of the time you can find it. I'll say as you get better at this, you get pretty good at just estimating it. And again, this is not perfect. Some people require even tighter T-lows, like they need even a higher rate to trap, right? And you just kind of have to adjust that as you see your patient. There's often you put them on APRV and they're not recruiting the way you want. And so you tighten your T-low even more. Most of the time, I tell people, you don't want to lengthen your T-low. It's almost always a mistake. And so just keeping your T-low, if you think it's the right place to start, keeping it there and not expanding it to a larger level usually keeps you out of trouble. Often when you extend your T-low, as the patient gets better, you end up de-recruiting them a little bit.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question. As the patient changes and their compliance changes, are you making adjustments to this T-low to kind of maintain that setting?
So I don't. The traditional teaching is yes. Like as their compliance improves, you are going to be trapping at higher and higher levels, right? Like, so you'll start at trapping at 75 and then all of a sudden you're trapping at like 85. But there's no real disadvantage in someone with a tight, wet, heavy lung at trapping at these higher levels. People are often scared that you're creating auto PEEP and you're going to breast stack. But remember, you're below FRC here. Your goal is to get them back to FRC. And so most patients, as you start trapping more, it means you're essentially getting them closer and closer to FRC. You're improving their VQ mismatch. You actually can ventilate them at a much easier rate. And so basically their minute ventilation requirements just keep going down and down. And so there's no reason really to extend their T low. I just keep it there and eventually just keep stretching their T high. And eventually they end up on CPAP and that's how they come off their T low. But I find most of the time people make the mistake of stretching their T low and it ends up de-recruiting people more often than it doesn't.
Okay. So what sorts of numbers are you usually seeing in your T-low? Like where might you start?
So usually somewhere between like 0.3 and 0.6. The sicker they are, the tighter it needs to be, right? Most people are somewhere around 0.5 0.4 if they're in ARDS and have a fairly sick lung. But again, it really depends on the individual patient. What I say is, like, your T-low should make, your T-low and your release volume should make sense for the patient in front of you. Right? If you have, like, you know, a 60 kilogram female with a super sick, wet, heavy lung and a P high of 35, then they should have a really tight release volume, right? Their release volume should be like 250 and their T-low should be 0.3, because that should be a patient with a super sick lung that if you let it fully exhale, it's going to do that almost instantaneously, right? But if you have a patient like we're talking about right now with a BMI of 40, you can imagine having this guy on a P high of 37 and have a T-low of 0.5 and a release volume of like 480, just because he's a bigger patient. A lot of his pressure is from extrapulmonary pressure of the chest wall, the abdomen, so on and so forth. So it should all make sense with the patient in front of you. As you start getting comfortable with APRV, you get a like more holistic understanding of the patient's lung, where they are in relation to FRC, and so on and so forth.
Okay. And then finally, the P low. Now, you said this should be zero. Is that always true? Is there any circumstance you would set higher than zero?
Yeah, the only circumstance is some ventilators are not ideal to use APRV on. And what I mean by that is they will kick out your T-low or allow the patient to kick out their T-low. So when the patient's super sick and they're heavily sedated or paralyzed and not participating in ventilation at all, you're fine. Your T-low stays at the fixed rate that you set it. But then as you start fixing them, they start waking up. The ventilator allows them to extend their T-low. And so you get these massive release volumes with massive swings, and you're going way below the 75% cutoff. The best thing to do is get them off that ventilator. It's just not a safe way of using APRV. But if you can't, for whatever reason, you can increase your P-low to try to decrease the speed at which they're kicking out and de-recruiting in those moments. It's not ideal. I hate it, but that would be the only time I would think about actually increasing my P-low to something over zero.
Can you share which ventilators you find that happens with?
So the old Puritan Bennett, like 800 model, would do it. The old servos would do it as well. The new servos are slightly better. The new Puritan Bennett's also seem to work fairly well with it. I'm trying to think. I think those are the ones I've had the most experience with that.
Okay.
With.
Now, is there a, because the other safety situation I could think about is, let's say there is a significant change in the patient's compliance, or somebody else comes along who doesn't really understand the mode, and one way or the other, the patient ends up just exhaling too much. Is there a downside to just putting people on a bit of a higher P-low so that there is kind of a floor in case you didn't trap them as much as you thought?
Usually the floor you're going to put them on doesn't make it safe if they're, you know, someone's allowing them to exhale or longer than they should, right? Like a P-low of 5.
I mean, 5 would be safer than 0,
right? But not by that much, right? Like usually that's still way below their pressure that's going to keep them open, right? So they're going to fully de-recruit one way or the other. Your driving pressure, yeah, will go from, you know, in this case, if you let them fully exhale, 37 to 32, neither one of them is good, right? It's not a good answer for what you're talking about. It doesn't really give you a good safety margin. You really have to be careful with your T-low, right? Like that's the key, is you have to make sure someone sets your T-low to a safe and appropriate level. And so the other problem with setting your P-low slightly higher is it greatly affects your flow rates, right? You'll watch your peak expiratory flow rates just drop because that initial driving pressure that you have set is now lower, right? And so you just get much less bulk ventilation. As a patient gets better and their minute ventilation requirements improve, bulk ventilation doesn't matter as much. It becomes much easier to ventilate people. But when you're putting someone on APRV and they're super sick, every little bit of ventilation you get really matters in that early period. Because again, you're losing minute ventilation. You're going from minute ventilations of 14, 12, you're coming down to 10 to 8, somewhere around that range. And you need all the bulk ventilation you can get. And so keeping that P high really helps with that as well.
All right. So you set somebody on these initial sorts of settings. We talked about some of the things to monitor. What does it matter what kind of volumes they're getting with their releases? I mean, is it, should you see these be in the general ballpark of a tidal volume breath, or do you not care as long as the ultimate minute ventilation is reasonable? Or on the other end, is there such a thing as too large, which is not lung protective?
Yeah. Yes and no to everything you said. So I always talk about this, like someone will look drastically different on APRV depending at what stage of their lung injury they're in. Without you touching the settings, their waveforms, their release volumes can change drastically. And it has to make sense for the patient in front of you. And so let's say we just talk about the patient we just placed on APRV. When you initially place him on, what were his tidal volumes on standard modes?
450.
Yeah. So typically when you set up APRV the way we talked about, the initial release volume you're going to get is smaller than the tidal volume you had on your traditional mode of ventilation. If it's not, you should think real hard why. And it's usually because you set your T low too long, right? And you're exhaling too much. But just mechanically, when you put someone on basically inverse settings, right? So you're using your plateau, which will be the peak of their inspiratory pressures on their normal mode of ventilation. And then you decide to cut that breath off at a much shorter rate than you're allowing them to breathe in on their standard mode of ventilation, you're going to get a smaller tidal volume. It's just what's going to happen. Typically that happens. As the patient recruits, their lung compliance gets better, they start trapping more and more. What you'll see is that tidal volume gets bigger naturally. This is much easier to do when you can draw out a graph, but when you set someone on a P low of zero, their expiratory flow curve is essentially determined by two things. One, the compliance of the lung, and the pressure that you set them at, right? And so as their compliance improves, without you touching the pressure, without you touching the T low, the curve, the inflection of the curve will just kind of flatten out, right? And you'll just start getting larger and larger tidal volumes as the lung recruits. So one of the things APRV does, it individually titrates a patient's tidal volume to the size of the lung that they have, right? So when they're super sick early in ARDS and you're recruiting them from this really small lung volume, they're going to have super protective settings. It's often going to be way lower than the 6 cc's per kg that we prescribe, right? It's usually like 4 or something. As you recruit them and they get better, those volumes are just going to increase naturally. If you care about that and you try to control it, APRV becomes very difficult. If you let it happen and understand that now the patient has the lung volumes to safely tolerate higher tidal volumes, then this naturally happens and you feel actually great about it. One of the metrics that you can use to measure this is the driving pressure, right? So how you measure driving pressure on APRV is you take your P high and you do an expiratory hold rather than an inspiratory hold. What the expiratory hold will do is tell you the pressure at end exhalation, so at the trough cutoff. So when T low ends and the lung reinflates, right at that moment, it's going to hold the vent. So it's going to tell you actually what pressure the lung is seeing at end expiration, right? So as we talked about, you never quite hit P0. You're going to actually end at your expiratory hold pressure. And so I often show people this because they're very worried about the P0. And you can show them like, no, this is the actual pressure in the lung at end expiration.
That's the peep per se.
That's the peep, right? The difference between those is going to be your driving pressure, right? And what happens with APRV is that end expiratory pressure just naturally increases and increases and increases as you start to recruit lung. So you will start off with a driving pressure that's fairly similar to the driving pressure you had on your standard mode of ventilation. And then as the patient gets better and you just trap lung, what you'll see is that trapping pressure starts at 10, goes to 12, goes to 15, goes to 18, goes to 20. And so your driving pressure gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And at the same time, your release volumes get bigger and bigger and bigger, right? And so you have this idea that I'm getting larger volumes, but guess what? The driving pressure is improving the whole time, meaning the compliance of the lung is improving and it's now able to tolerate that. It's one of the best markers that you're winning on APRV is this kind of idea of I started with this really small release volume and this really big driving pressure, and I've just inverted those two, right? Now my release volume is big, but my driving pressure is much less. So I'd much rather have a large release volume and a low driving pressure than the opposite. right? You shouldn't have a high release volume and a high driving pressure, right? That means you're doing something wrong with your APRV. Usually you set your T low wrong in those cases.
Okay. And your reference for the driving pressure here is similar to what it would be in any mode. So, you know, somewhere in, I don't know, low teens is, would be nice. And
yeah, yes. What I will say is you want it as low as you can get it. You're just going to watch it. Like often right before I flip someone the CPAP and extubate them, they have a driving pressure of like 2, right? Like this is like, it's just going to get better over time if you've set your APRV correctly. Again, most of the time, if your driving pressure is too high on your initial APRV settings, it was too high on your standard mode settings, right? It almost always will be better than the standard mode settings because your release volumes are just naturally lower than they were in your traditional modes of ventilation. But I don't mind if my driving pressure is initially 18, if it starts improving, because that's what I want, right? I usually, if they're super sick and on their traditional modes of ventilation, they already have a driving pressure of 19 or 20, and I flip them and my driving pressure is now 18, I don't fiddle with my settings to decrete this because my hope is, as I recruit, that's going to improve over time.
Okay. So if a conventional-minded person said, I don't think that this mode is lung protective, because when you're maybe starting out, as in this patient, their plateau is 37, so if we set their P high at 37, they're like, that's too high. And if they, as they improve, maybe we brought that down, but now they're getting release volumes, which might equate to tidal volumes of 550 or something like that, and they say, well, that's too high. So either way, you're either too much volume or too much pressure. You would say, yeah, but in both cases, the driving pressure is safe. So in the like conventional model, that would be the argument.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way I look at it is, right, in the end, what you're trying to do when you ventilate someone with protective modes of ventilation is I am trying to give them a volume that's appropriate for the size of lung that the patient has, right? And then I'm using methods to predict that. And none of them are great, right? Like the 6 cc's per kg, we know there's plenty of CT data showing it's not very predictive of the actual size of a patient's lung, right? And that's why we use surrogates like plateau pressure or driving pressure. Essentially, both of those our surrogates for asking is the volume I'm giving safe for the size of the patient's lung, right? And as those pressures go higher for any given volume, it means that lung is getting smaller, right? And we've picked arbitrary cutoffs of 30 and 14, and arbitrary is probably not fair. There's inflection points that show, you know, you start to have increased mortality. But essentially, those are just telling me, is the volume of gas appropriate for the size of lung that I have? And I'm okay with any given volume, whether it's 6 cc's, 8 cc's, 10 cc's, as long as the patient's volume, patient's lungs are appropriate to safely tolerate that, right? And that's way more based off someone's driving pressure than simply their plateau pressure, right? The plateau pressure has the limitation that it doesn't take into the patient's PEEP or their trapping pressure. It doesn't take into the extrapulmonary pressures that are involved in someone's chest wall, and so on and so forth. And so I think your driving pressure is a more accurate answer to that question. And then that gets into the more important question of, you know, what is the actual data on lung protective ventilation and what does it say? And for the most part, it's somewhat overstated, right? Most of the time we talk about the ARMOR trial. And a lot of people, I'm not sure, have read it, but essentially what you're looking at with the ARMOR trial is they compared 6 cc's per kg with a plateau pressure of 12, with a plateau pressure of 30 to 12 cc's per kg. So these massive lung volumes and people that had like really small lungs. And not surprisingly, people that got small lung volumes who had small lungs did better. What it didn't show, which is probably the more important question, is an empiric 6 cc's per kg better than individually titrating the volume of someone's tidal volume to the actual lung that they have, right? So as the lung improves, we can expand that volume. We all do that. Like we pretend we don't, but as someone gets better and you put them on pressure support or what other mode, you just start to relax what they need, right? We're all sitting right here right now talking and breathing. No one's measuring what our tidal volumes are, right? Because once you start breathing on your own, you have an inherent idea of what your safe tidal volume is in your lung. As someone gets sick and their lung gets wet and heavy and their VQ matching starts to fail, right? To maintain a CO2, they start breathing above a safe tidal volume, right? That's what respiratory distress looks like. And that's why we start to get concerned and we intubate people and we protect their lung. And so a lot of it is understanding where a patient is in relation to FRC and what a safe volume is. And you do that by using your driving pressure and watching your driving pressure decrease and your tidal volume increase. But it all becomes way easier once you start allowing someone to breathe. Because once you allow someone to breathe, you're less concerned about what tidal volume they're taking per se and more concerned about the quality of their breath. Does it look safe? Is it a comfortable breath that someone's just kind of, like we're breathing right now, just sitting here kind of relaxing and breathing? Or does it look like someone's in respiratory distress and are pulling with the mechanics of someone that's breathing below FRC?
Okay, well, so that's what I wanted to ask next. Like, must a patient breathe spontaneously to be on APRV? Because some people would say that's like part and parcel of this mode. If they're not doing any breathing, you either can't or at least it's very difficult to use APRV. But certainly when you first maybe put a patient on the ventilator, sometimes that's possible and sometimes it's not. What do you think?
Yeah, so that's a total myth. What determines whether someone can breathe on APRV or not is where they are in relation to FRC, right? The closer they get and the more they are close to FRC, the easier it is for them to breathe on their own. When they're super sick and have this really small lung, they can't breathe on their own. This is the second big mistake that I see people do, and often what causes failure is they put them on APRV when they've got this tiny, tight little ball of a lung, and they try to ask them to breathe, and you just can't do it. What APRV is, it's CPAP. And it's CPAP to get someone back to FRC and then allow them to breathe on their own. But because the lung recruits over time, it doesn't recruit instantaneously, there's a period where I need to let the lung recruit and I'm ventilating for you with your release volumes, right? In that period before they're at FRC, they can't breathe on their own. It's just unsafe. And you'll see what their breath look like. They're these like very spiky breaths where they're taking massive peak inspiratory flows, very narrow because they just don't have the ability to breathe that far below FRC. The other thing that you'll notice is people are super uncomfortable on the vent when they have a tight, heavy lung, and that's their minute ventilation requirements are super high, right? Because their VQ mismatch is so bad because their lung is so de-recruited, they'll have minute ventilation requirements of 14. You can't ask someone to breathe on their own when they have a minute ventilation of 14. It's not the minute ventilation itself, right? If I ask you to do some form of exercise and you start breathing on your own and generate minute ventilation of 14, that's fine because you have a normal lung, right? But once the lung is a wet, heavy ball, the minute ventilation requirement is more a marker of how sick your lung is. And so early in APRV, they can't breathe on their own. They'll just be too sick you won't be able to do it safely. And it's that period where you're basically ventilating them entirely with the release volumes. As the lung improves, what you're going to see is just improvements in those minute ventilation requirements. And you reach a point where essentially you get back to a normal minute ventilation of somewhere around 5 or 6. That's when you start to ask them to start breathing on their own.
That's interesting because I know people kind of debate about whether this is a comfortable mode to breathe in. And a lot of people would say it's not comfortable to breathe on top of the high P high because there's already so much air in your chest. But it sounds like you're saying what really is not comfortable and what perhaps they're seeing is them trying to breathe in a lung that is not well recruited. And once you open the lung up, it is comfortable even if their P high is 25 or something.
Yeah. So, and we can address this in a couple of ways. When you look at the actual data comparing like sedation requirements with people with APRV with standard modes, APRV always has less sedation, less need for paralytics, so on and so forth. That's pretty shown consistently throughout the data. Now, the reason why this is, yes, is correcting your minute ventilation requirements. I think the biggest like marker of distress on the ventilator is this inability to control one CO2. Like if I asked you guys to hold your breath right now, you'll do it for a minute and a half, and then you'll have this unbelievable drive to breathe, and your CO2 is going from 40 to like 43, right? And so we control our CO2s incredibly tightly, and not and forcing someone to have high CO2s drives them insane, right? You see this with asthmatics all the time, right? You just can't sedate them on the ventilator. Because that CO2 drive is so high. When you have this VQ mismatch and these whopping minute ventilation requirements, it's really hard to keep someone comfortable without sedating them, right? As you get them back to FRC, those minute ventilation requirements normalize and it becomes much, much easier to keep people comfortable on the ventilator, right? And so you'll see when you have someone on APRV early on in the disease, they're on pretty similar sedation settings to what they are on their normal modes of ventilation, whether it's high sedation and paralysis or without paralysis. As you start improving your minute ventilation requirements and get it close to normal, you can peel those back almost completely towards the end where you're on almost nothing and they're sort of awake on the vent. In fact, that's part of how you manage APRV early in the disease when you don't want them to breathe spontaneously because they're too sick. You're using your propofol, your fentanyl, your things that sedate your respiratory drive to stop them from breathing. As they get better and they get closer to FRC and now you're asking them to breathe again, you're gonna switch to medications that don't suppress your respiratory drive, ketamine, dexmedetomidine, Haldol, and stuff that allows you to breathe and gives them back that respiratory drive.
So if you were taking a patient on a conventional mode like this and switching them, or you know, let's say you did intubate someone and immediately put them on APRV, you would sedate them fairly deeply, probably much as they would be on another mode, because we generally want people to be really very synchronous initially. And you would say not only is it okay if they're not making any spontaneous breaths over their APRV, but I prefer. I really don't want to see significant breathing.
Yeah, I mean, we're assuming that it's a sick lung, and I'm using APRV because I'm trying
to not some
them.
Stable person. Would right. Do you paralyze people ever? Or
yeah, if you have to.
Same as
again,
else.
Like if you look at the Zhao trial and the other data on APRV, you have to paralyze people less. But there's people you have to paralyze. You know, in COVID, often in the early stages, their minute ventilation requirements are so high you have to paralyze them. But there's no rule, right? You're basically just saying you are too sick to breathe. I'm going to stop you from breathing. I'm going to use medication to suppress your respiratory drive. And if I have to, I'm going to paralyze you. Usually I find you have to paralyze people at most for a day. And as you recruit them, that need just goes away. And you don't know until you try, right? Like I'll just take the paralytics off and see what happens.
And it's interesting to hear. It sounds like you're saying early in their course here, when they're that sick, not only do you need sedation and maybe paralysis because you don't want to see a lot of spontaneous breaths that are probably not safe, but maybe you also need the sedation because at this phase, it's a safe bet that they're going to be somewhat acidotic and that's probably very uncomfortable. So it kind of goes the other way too. To get them to tolerate this kind of permissive hypercarbia, they're probably going to need some sedation for that as well. Whereas later they might be able to manage their acid base much better and they could be more awake.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's essentially the same thing you're doing with your standard mode of ventilation. You don't often realize it because you're not, you know, you say it's vent dysynchrony. I'll tell you that's just because the patient's going insane because their CO2
that's
is
them
50,
trying
right?
to breathe more.
Yeah. And so, you know, people hate all modes of ventilation when their CO2's high. But you can have someone on like really crappy modes of ventilation, but as long as their minute ventilation requirements okay, they can be like sitting up and watching TV, right? Like you, it's amazing what people do when once you fix that.
So is it really, could you say that the time to start allowing them to breathe is when their pH is normal-ish?
Yeah, I don't so much care about the pH. What I look at is what is the minute ventilation requirement to maintain a normal CO2, right? And so like take, for example, our patient. You said they had a PCO2 of around 50. Their minute ventilation was somewhere around 11 or 12, right? I think on their
yeah,
mode of
rate
ventilation.
Of 20, volume of 450. Yeah. So
let's just say like 11 for funsies. You're going to put them on APRV. We'll probably drop them a minute ventilation of 9. I wanted to see what happens to that initial gas, right? And if you get your gas and your PCO2 stays the same or goes down, that's a really good sign. what you'll start to see is what I call the passive stretch, which is essentially as you recruit lung and your minute ventilation requirements improve, you'll see you can just increase your T high naturally without asking them to breathe. They're still sedated. You're not asking them to breathe at all. But because you're improving their VQ matching and because you're recruiting lung, you're now able to ventilate them less often. Right. And so what you'll see is their initial gas will come back at 50. Then all of a sudden their PCO2 will come back at 40. Then all of a sudden they're hypocapnic and they've got a PCO2 of 30, and you stretch their T high from 2 to 3. And you just keep doing that until you get to a normal minute ventilation. And so their ventilation goes from 11 to 8 to 7 to 6 to 5. Now I've basically got them close to a normal FRC and I've normalized their minute ventilation requirements. So now if I start stretching their T high any longer, they're gonna start getting hypercapnic unless I ask them to breathe on their own. This is where APRV transitions from basically a completely non-spontaneous mode of ventilation to a spontaneous mode of ventilation, right? Once you've gotten them back to a normal FRC, and now you're asking, is it safe for them to breathe again, right? And it's not always perfect. Sometimes you start asking them to breathe and you're like, oh, they're not quite ready yet. So you kind of decrease your T high again, maybe increase your sedation again, and then you spend another day diuresing them or doing what else you are doing to fix the problem. That's the moment where it switches from a mandatory to a spontaneous mode of ventilation.
Okay, so initially they will gradually ventilate more efficiently because their lung is getting more and more recruited. And as they do, you're going to stretch out your T high so that you're getting fewer releases and overall less of a minute ventilation just from the ventilator itself. And once you get to the point where that minute ventilation is in the kind of normal physiologic realm, first of all, you don't... they're probably about as efficient as they're going to be. That's an opened up lung. Yeah. And now any further stretching you do is for the intentional purpose of hypoventilating them so that they have a trigger to start breathing on their own. And that's when you also would want to lighten sedation so they do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And then initially when you're putting them on, and they probably are a bit acidotic, is the kind of realm for how much of that is okay the same kind of realm that we would consider in any patient, which frankly probably mostly comes down to each person's nerve. Like, I don't know what the right pH or PCO2 is, but there's not really a right answer here, but it's whatever they tolerate.
Yeah, there's not. I think the harms of hypercapnic acidosis are fairly overstated. Like, we have fairly good data that acidosis in and of itself is not the problem. It's the underlying cause of the acidosis. And people tolerate hypercapnia quite well. My concern with the hypercapnic respiratory acidosis is not the acidosis itself. It's a marker of how bad the lung is. And then it's also a marker of if APRV is working or not. Like you would see in COVID that people who were on the ventilator for 2 to 3 weeks and they had reached that fibrotic stage of the disease, APRV just bounced off them. It didn't work. And you would know really quickly. You would put them on APRV and you would watch their CO2s just shoot up. Like they would go from like 60, 70 to like 90 or 100, right? And then over the course of the first 6 hours, there was nothing. Like they just didn't recruit, right? And again, it wasn't the acidosis that was a problem. It was just a marker that how sick the lung was and the fact that it wasn't opening up, right? So I'll tolerate pretty high CO2s to start. That's where they were before. I'm really concerned when they have really high minute ventilations and are still hypercapnic. To me, that's a marker of a super sick lung. And the smaller the lung is, the more dangerous it is to put someone on APRV to start. Because one, you're dropping that minute ventilation, and if you're not making it up with recruitment, it becomes really difficult to ventilate. The other thing is like the lung instantaneously over distends and recruits over time. So when you put someone on APRV, when they're super, super sick and have a super, super small lung, you're going to over distend what little lung they have. And you'll see all kinds of hemodynamic perturbations in those moments. And it's always more scary and dangerous when someone has really high CO2s with really high minute ventilations. It's just an indicator that their lung is tiny.
Now, yeah. So are those people who just, I mean, if you can't in reasonable time recruit somebody's lung with APRV, does that mean you should have done something else? Or does that mean that's just that they're that sick and they need ECMO or something else that doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's both, right? Like, you should have, this should have been something you had recognized way earlier on, right? I always say that, like, APRV shouldn't be a surprise, right? They weren't normal one day and had APRV the next. Every once in a while that happens, but most of the time this is the disease over time. And if you're watching someone's minute ventilation requirements, you will quickly identify when they're losing lung volumes and you can prevent it. If you've gotten to a point where someone's minute ventilation requirements are double, triple normal and they're already hypercapnic, this has been happening for a while and you probably should have intervened with APRV much earlier. Yes, when you have someone with minute ventilations of 14 and a PCO2 of 70, like, it's pretty hard to get them onto APRV. You can try, but it's very hard, and that's definitely when ECMO is a consideration.
Weaning. We talked about starting to stretch out your T highs. Traditionally, most people would say you're weaning down your P high as well. Is this something you're doing?
No. I think this is probably the third place where people get into trouble, right? Yeah, the traditional teaching is you drop and stretch together. So for every time you stretch, you drop your P-high. But what I will find that does is you de-recruit people by dropping your P-high too early. So I've separated the two. The way I think about it is you're stretching your T-high as your minute ventilation requirements allow you to, right? And that's initially happens with this passive stretch we talked about, where as you get people closer to FRC, your minute ventilation requirements just start to normalize, right? Then once you're at a normal minute ventilation, farther stretching is now asking them to breathe on top of that. And again, you can just stretch them all the way to CPAP if they're breathing safely. And that's a marker of looking at the quality of their breath. And if it looks like they're taking a comfortable natural breath, and that's somewhat of a subjective statement. But what we talk about, if you look at the ventilator and look at your flow rates, their flows, their inspiratory flows should be wider than they are tall as they start to get those like peakish flows where their flow rates shoot up and drop down. That's an indicator that it's not a safe breath. Their pressure curve should be rather stable as they start tugging down on your pressure line. Again, that's an indicator that they're taking these massive inspiratory, they're changing their inspiratory or their intrathoracic pressure too drastically.
And those suggest to you that their P-high is too low.
No, those suggest to me that they're just not at FRC yet. I have to figure out why. That can be multiple reasons, but it suggests to me they're not ready to breathe on their own. It could be too high, it could be too low. You have to take into account the patient in front of you in that moment, right? So there's times, let's take our patient, we started him at a P high of 37. Let's say he's day three, I've supined him, I've woken him up, his minute ventilation is now 5. I've spent 3 days diuresing him a great deal, right? And now I ask him to breathe, and yeah, he's not breathing the way I'd like. It might be because his P-high is too high at this moment, right? And so I would probably drop it a little bit and see, but that's because I have the context of the fact that I've done something to fix the disease. So the T-high, you titrate it based on your minute ventilation requirements. The P-high, you titrate based on the state of the disease in the moment, right? And so I tend not to touch my P-high very often until I've woken the patient up and started to watch them breathe. I find it's much easier to figure out what P-high you should be at or how to titrate it once you watch them breathe, because if you drop your P-high too early, and you're just doing it off the release volumes, it takes a while to recognize de-recruitment. Like, it doesn't happen instantaneously, and you can de-recruit someone and you're kind of like hours behind the ball on re-recruiting them back up. If they're already spontaneously breathing, once you start to drop your P high and you're doing it too soon, what you'll see is basically what a failed SBT looks like, right? Their tidal volumes will get smaller and their respiratory rate will get higher. And that happens really quickly, and it's a really sensitive marker of de-recruitment. And so it's much easier to fiddle with your P high once you've started woken them up and asking them to breathe. Sometimes I do it at the same time. Someone's on like a P high of 37 and I've spent days waking them up, diuresing them. And I'm like, all right, maybe they can come down to 35 and now I'll ask them to breathe. But most of the time I spend a good few hours watching them breathe on my initial P high before I start dropping it.
Okay.
So you can be at very high T highs. You can have them, doing a lot of ventilation without dropping your P high very much. often they happen together because you're fixing the disease at the same time as you're stretching them. But you want to think about them as different reasons for doing them, right? T-high based on minute ventilation requirements, P-high based on where you are in their disease state.
Okay. Okay, real quick, lightning. Two possibilities. Is hypotension, maybe severe shock, a contraindication to APRV?
No. One, it depends on why someone's hypotensive. If you look at SWAN data on APRV, if you look at data on pressor vasoactive requirements, they're all, your SWAN data is better on APRV than your standard mode of ventilation. Your pressor requirements improve typically. That's because your heart functions best at FRC, right? You have your best pulmonary compliance curves, you have your best venous return, so on and so forth. Getting someone to FRC makes everything better. The caveat is, like we said earlier, when you put someone on APRV, you overdistend instantly and you recruit over time. So there are moments when you put someone onto APRV, you will see your pressor requirements go up, your desaturation. Typically, those are small perturbations and you can just ride it out. When they're super, super sick, like we talked about, it can be something that stops you from putting them on APRV, but that's a super rare case.
Okay. What about the prior presence of barotrauma? Maybe they have a pneumothorax or some similar sort of leak.
Yeah, again, it shouldn't stop you from putting someone on APRV. If you look at the ZAO data, the actual rate of pneumothorax was higher in the standard lung protective group than it was in the APRV group. And this is simply because the larger your lung volume, the more individual lung units you have, the less strain on any individual lung unit, right? And so the closer you are to FRC, the safer your lung is at tolerating any volume. I'd much rather have a release volume of 8 to 10 cc's per kg and a driving pressure of 4 than a release volume of 4 cc's per kg and a driving pressure of 20. This idea that, if you've got a pneumothorax, you basically have an injury to the lung, right? If you put more air through that injury, it's going to take it longer to heal than if you expand the whole lung and take pressure off of it, right? And so, it shouldn't defer you that in of itself from using APRV. Okay.
So ultimately, in both these cases, you probably end up in a better state, although it could be that while you recruit, it could be hit or miss.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. All right. Wow, what a whirlwind. Brian, other questions?
Where to start? No, this has been helpful. This is something that, everybody kind of has things that for whatever reason you just seem to have a block against. And this is one for me that just trying to get my head around it. Conceptually, I understand it, the nuts and bolts. So this has been helpful. Part of that I think is I practice mostly in a neuro ICU and a surgical ICU, and we just don't do this a whole lot because we don't have a whole lot of real horrible ARDS. So it seems like from what you're saying that a lot of this is very much kind of individualized. You just kind of have to know what you're doing, right? It's not algorithmic like a lot of things that we do. So what do you do if you're somebody like me who doesn't use this a lot? How do I get comfortable with it?
Yeah, I mean, that's often one of the big barriers with APRV. I would say that's your barrier to anything in life, in medicine, right?
Sure, yeah.
if you don't know it and you're not comfortable with it, it's hard to do it. So it's basically, how do you get good at anything, which is practice, talk to people who are good at it, learn it. APRV, I think, is somewhat harder because of how we're traditionally taught ventilation, which is very prescriptive, meaning I am going to put you on this much tidal volume with this much rate, with this much PEEP and this much oxygen. I'm going to get a blood gas and I'm going to adjust it based off that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to sedate and paralyze you to force you to be on those settings, right? And APRV is like, well, I have these settings that do this and this, and I'm basically using them to get you back to FRC and get you to breathe, right? So it's a lot kind of more vague and subjective. But I think the advantage is once you've become good at it, you have a much better understanding of any patient's lung. Like I ask my residents all the time, like where, even our attendings, like where is this patient in relation to FRC? And no one has any idea. Like they don't have to be on APRV. It can be on whatever mode of ventilation, but no one thinks about the lung like that. And that's why you miss ARDS. Like you said, like I don't see a lot of ARDS and I don't use a lot of APRV on without COVID anymore because a lot of my patients just never get there, right? Because I understand where they are in relation to FRC and I've intervened way before I need something like APRV. Most of my patients exist on some form of CPAP with some form of support for the flow work of breathing. Like either pressure support or ATC or something, right? Mm. But if you're watching someone breathe and you understand where you are in relation to FRC, you really don't need APRV a lot, right? Your patients should be existing on the more CPAP stage of the APRV continuum. It's only when something catastrophic very quickly happens or if people haven't been paying attention to the patient and their lungs and where they are in relation to FRC that APRV becomes more of the mode that we think of it as, which is these high pressure release volumes, mandatory mode of ventilation.
Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the take home then for folks like me from this episode is not necessarily here's how to do APRV good, but here's how to recognize FRC and
value it.
And not need to get to APRV.
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of the biggest things I teach people, one of the biggest things when you start learning APRV is like the value of minute ventilation on the ventilator. It is like a super valuable marker that nobody pays attention to. Like you can go on service any day and you can look at someone on like very minimal vent settings that's failing their SPTs every day. And you can just walk and look at their vent, not when they're on SPT, just when they're on their normal settings, you'll see their minute ventilation is like 13. And 12, and look what's happening. Like their lung is a little wet ball that no one's paid attention to. Their minute ventilation requirements are super high, and they're pulling at lung volumes that just aren't proficient to work, right? There's no way they're going to pass an SPT until you start getting them back to FRC, right? They don't need APRV. They probably just need fairly aggressive diuresis and you know, a better PEEP and CPAP level. But just being able to be in tune with that and recognize that in and of itself is a huge value.
All right, everybody, that is it for today. And just want to remind you guys that these are just our thoughts. They don't represent our institutions that we work for necessarily. And of course, it's just educational stuff. This is not medical advice. And hopefully you're not basing your entire practice and decisions on what you hear us say. So thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.